Julian thinks very deeply for 40 or 50 years and develops incredible conceptual insight. And then luckily he leaves us things to do, because he lets us explore explicit models where these insights are realized. And then sometimes when you explore these models in detail, you see that some things happen that you might not have expected. So today I want to give the first half of my talk will be a formalization, a practical formalization of the ideas of what Julian was explaining about the n-body problem, and then also about classical general relativity. And about some of this will also appear in Yuri Bonder's talk this afternoon, because he will go very explicitly through a different model about the shape dynamics description of a toy model universe. And then at the end, I want to say this is, for me, the motivation to work on shape dynamics was from the very beginning was that it opens new ideas about quantum gravity. So about 10 years ago, I was working on quantum gravity, on loop quantum gravity, and I saw quite a few conceptual issues in quantum gravity. And it was actually when I started here in 2008, postdoc at Perimeter, was when in the first week I heard a talk by Julian. Julian was invited at the Foundations of the Law of Physics conference, something of that sort. And it rang so many bells with me that I started to talk with Julian, and this is and over time we developed some models that I think are actually working. So today I gave like a subtitle, which is the quantum equation of state of the universe produces a small cosmological constant, which is a very catchy title. What I want to do with this is grab your attention, and I want to say, well, at least this, I'm still working towards quantum gravity, and if you take as you will see during my talk, if you take the shape dynamics logic, this conceptual framework that Julian has developed over about 50 years, if you take that seriously, then you come up with postulates for quantum gravity, and you can actually use these when you make them concrete in a model to calculate something. So the outline of my argument will be the following. I will start with a poor man's version. Julian gave a much nicer introduction about the conceptual idea, about what I mean with relationalism, but I need to be concrete what I mean with relationalism. So I say it's a disentanglement of physical law from the operational definition of physical objects, of the things, of physical quantities. And then I will formalize this and postulate that the equation of, or that the dynamics of the universe as a whole, or of a toy model universe, should be an equation of state for geometric properties of a curve in relational configuration space. And then I will go, argue that the simplest way to extend these classical ideas that we developed over a couple of years, to extend them to quantum theories, is to apply these ideas that we developed for the equation of state for classical curves on relational configuration space, on shape space, to Bohmian trajectories on shape space. So I'm not considering strictly quantum mechanics, I'm considering a particular version of Bohmian mechanics on shape space. Then I will go, and I hope I will have time to cover all of that, will go through several developments, because all of these points here will give you some hunch of what a reasonable quantum gravity model based on shape dynamics could look like. So I end up with some postulates that are based on shape dynamics, and then I apply this to a Bianchi model that is coupled to a matter field with local degrees of freedom, and there you can see that the equation of state of the curve that is traced out by this Bianchi model in the presence of a scalar field in this Bohmian language is not affected by the vacuum energy density that is produced by this model. And when I talked to Julian the first time about this, he said this is because we define away this caloric, and it was in a phone conversation a couple of months ago, because we don't have the local volume element as a physical degree of freedom, and therefore it doesn't. So at a very bird's eye view, that's why it doesn't affect the curve on shape space. So let me start with my Pullman's version of relationalism. So as I mentioned, it's for me in the one line definition is that it's a disentanglement of law from definition. You can make this in a very simple example. Consider we have three particles and we already have a notion of Euclidean geometry for how three particles are. I mean, I need to allow for some notion. Then Newton's first law says that in an inertial system, three particles move along straight lines at constant speed. But in this, I put in italics inertial system at constant speed, because an inertial system is defined by its physical properties. An inertial system is a system in which three particles move along straight lines. So at first sight, of course, this seems tautological. But of course, if you have more than two particles, the particles themselves can be used, some of the particle degrees of freedom can be used to find the inertial system. And then the rest of this statement that all particles move along straight lines at constant speed gives predictions once you have identified the inertial system. And the same thing is for the notion of speed, which requires an intrinsic notion of units, in particular of clock and rod. Actually, in a system of free particles, these are entangled due to a symmetry that free particles have to the dynamical similarity in the free particle case. But then we know how to identify or how to do this disentanglement between this law and this definition. For example, when we have an n particle system, the system that Julian was talking about, you can fix the coordinate origin of the inertial frame as the center of mass of the system. You can fix the orientation of the frame of the inertial system, basically saying particle one defines the x direction at one instant of time, and the orthogonal component of particle two onto this direction defines the y direction. Generically, they're not collinear. So then you get a frame because you just need x dx which dy to define a frame. And then you can, in this inertial system, you can use part of the degree of freedom of a third particle to define a unit of speed. And then the remaining statement in an inertial system, free particles move along straight lines at constant speed, then become objective predictions about the behavior of the system. And they can be read off the what Julian was already pointing out, curves in shape space. They can be they make predictions about what the curve in shape space looks like. So what object, without referring to a specific unit of length scale, without referring to a specific inertial frame, and without referring to an external clock in the system, they make actual predictions about the motion of the system. So this is so in one line, a relational description that extracts the true predictions of physics. So to make this formal, to be able to turn this into formulas, I say the objective dynamics is the geometry of the curve in configuration space. So when we say we want to describe the whole universe, or we want to at least describe a toy model for the whole universe, then I have to have all these reference structures and all these conventions that in particular define units have to be units that are defined within this system. So this means that only relational configurations exist, meaning that only ratios between reference objects and measured objects exist. So this is relational configuration space, but no absolute configuration. And only change exists, but no explicit time parameterization. The explicit time parameterization should come out from physical clocks that you put in the system. So theoretically, I postulate that the description of such a toy model universe should be an equation of state of the geometry of a pure, this is unparameterized curve in shape space. So what do I mean with that? So if I have here this bubble here be shape space, then I have a curve here that is traced out. That is my history of the universe. I don't want to refer to any parameterization, but what I can do is, of course, I can introduce local coordinates on shape space. So this I call DQA, point in shape space. So I'm at this point, and at this point, I have a direction, which is a unit tangent vector modulus. So I take out from a tangent vector the absolute length. So I refer to an auxiliary metric that I put on by hand on this just to get a representation. Mathematically, it's a point in the unit tangent bundle over shape space, and a point in the fiber defines a direction. So I have points, directions, and what it turns out, what Julian was referring to at one point, is that the dynamics also depends on the ratio of kinetic energy that is in expansion versus kinetic energy that is in the change of shape. And it turns out that this is related to the curvature of the curve in shape space. So if I measure with a particular metric the curvature, of course, curvature is a metric-dependent statement. It's the deviation from geodesics, so if I have geodesics and I take the unit tangent vector on a geodesic, I look how does the unit tangent vector when I move along the curve, how does it change, and I subtract the one of the geodesic, or I take the covariant derivative along the curve of the unit tangent vector is the same thing, then I get a deviation from geodesic, and the curvature is basically the length of this deviation. And it turns out that we need this to close the dynamical system to describe Newtonian dynamics, or in general relativity, a similar ratio appears in the description. I will show that during the middle of my talk. So when I say the geometry is an equation of state of this unparameterized curve, then I refer to this. I have how the point, the direction, and the curvature of the curve change. When I change one of these, how do the other ones have to change? As I go, and this describes completely the dynamics or the curve that is traced out. So let me give you an example how to do that, and I do the simplest non-trivial example, which is the example that Julian also used. So I use Newton's equation. So I have Newtonian dynamics. I say R dot is V, so I have the change of position is the momentum of this particle over its mass, and then the change of momentum is minus the gradient of the potential. What I do then is I identify two scale degrees of freedom. I don't worry at this point, for simplicity, I don't worry about fixing the inertial frame, because there are technical issues with that, and the conceptual advancement comes from separating out the scale, so the size and the duration. So I take here, when I have an equal mass case, I take the trace of the center of moment, the square root of the trace of the center of moment of inertia. This defines me a scale for the system. When I divide it by the total mass, this is what I call capital R, which is basically the size of the ball of n particles. And how it changes, Julian already introduced this d, this dilatation momentum, which is the virial, the p dot r, sum over all particles. So I try to separate the motion of these degrees of freedom from the motion of the shape degrees of freedom, so which are the relative coordinates. So, you know, for example, divide all coordinates by the size of the universe. That's one particular chart. This is a typo. There should be a pi here. This should be the momenta that I have up there. Sorry. So yes, this is a typo, because here on the right-hand side, I refer to the PAs as the momenta conjugate to the QAs, to the points on shape space or on pre-shape space. And then what I want is I want to get rid of the time parametrization. So a simple thing is to say, if I have a metric on pre-shape space, if I have a kinematic metric, then I can describe the curve in arc length parametrization. And this is what I will do.
Where'd you get that formula for the P's? Is there a simple reason why you use that?
This one? No, this is just a canonical transformation that separates between R and D and the shape degrees of freedom, and you get it's just then you need the partial derivative and the inverse of this matrix to get the momenta. So then the first equation, like in the Newtonian case, becomes a purely kinematic statement. R dot is V. This says here, if I make a unit step on shape space, then it's the unit tangent vector. I go a unit tangent vector away, where this phi here is parametrizing the direction. So what I'm really doing is I use the q's and phi's as local coordinates in the unit tangent bundle. So if I have a Riemannian manifold, for example, shape space, and I put an auxiliary metric on it, then there is the unit sphere in the tangent bundle that defines the unit tangent bundle, and I put local coordinates phi in the fiber and q in the base space, and those are the. So the first one is just the kinematic statement, but then of course I have to go along and calculate what is the evolution of these angles. I just use Newton's equations and the chain rule to calculate this. And I see here, well, there is the gradient of the potential again. Then I divide by the total kinetic energy. This just turns out to be to come out of Newton's equations when I reparametrize them to arc lengths on shape space. But these are all dimensionful constants. These are all dimensionful quantities that appear here, the kinetic energy and the gradient of the potential.
Could I ask a question? The g metric?
No, at this point, I'm not specifying any particular metric. But for you, it's the best matched metric on shape space. It's the kinematic metric, so delta AB and IJ for the particles, and best matched, so it's on shape space.
So how are you defining the potential?
The potential at this point is just an arbitrary Newtonian potential, an arbitrary potential. And in 1 second, I will go make it specific which potential I use. So as in Julian's case, I will assume that the potential is homogeneous of degree minus one in the total scale degree of freedom. And then you see that when it's homogeneous of degree minus one, it depends on the shape degrees of freedom as some function q divided by the overall scale. And of course, there's a dimension for coupling constant, which I indicated by this alpha here. And to make C positive, I put this minus sign here for the Newton potential.
Sorry, does the G depend on V?
No, G does not depend on V. You see this here. So then I see, well, all the dimensions are now in R, in the overall size of the momenta, and in this alpha here. And now I can rewrite the equation that I derived on the previous slide in completely dimensionless quantities once I identify this degree of freedom kappa, the size of the shape, the size of the kinetic energy in terms of alpha, in terms of alpha times R, this coupling constant, and the total scale. And then I need to calculate the equation of motion for this kappa degree of freedom to close the system. I again use Newton's equations. I see that the ratio of that the right-hand side depends on the longitudinal part of the force in shape space, so in the direction of motion, in the direction of the curve. And it depends on the square root of this ratio that I mentioned of the kinetic energy in expansion and the shape kinetic energy. So then I use the condition that Julian also mentioned, that I take the total energy to be zero and use this constraint to solve for kappa. Basically to eliminate this ratio. And then I find a ratio that this is kappa times this 2 times C over kappa minus 1, the square root of that. And what Julian referred to as the gravitational error of time, this is the thing that I will use to determine the sign here, which prefers the positive sign because it's in the direction of expansion, is what we argue that the perceived error of time is always. So now I have the equation. Now I have the equation of state. I express it in how the shape changes when I go along the curve, how the direction changes when I go along the curve, and how this kappa degree of freedom changes when I go along the curve. So far I've just used the dimensionless ratio to define kappa, but actually it is related to the extrinsic curvature of the curve. So if I, whatever metric I use, it's the geodesic, it's the length of the geodesic deviation is by definition the extrinsic curvature of the curve. And you just plug this in and you see that this kappa degree of freedom is the curvature radius multiplied by the length of the gradient of the shape potential squared. So this means I could rewrite these equations, they just become larger and not as nice, and express everything in terms of kappa, in terms of k, in terms of the extrinsic curvature. And what I want for you to note here is that this decoupling of R and D, of these two scale degrees of freedom, that will always happen because one of them can be generically eliminated using the energy conservation as a constraint. And the other one will always happen due to dimensional analysis. On the left-hand side, I have something that is dimensionless and scale invariant, in particular dimensionless. This is a shape, how the shape changes in term when I go a unit step in arc length. So the right-hand side has to be dimensionless. So if I have eliminated one, if I have only two dimensional quantities remaining, I eliminated one by the energy conservation condition. Then the other one is eliminated simply by decoupling, by the fact that you have dimensional homogeneity of the equations. So this is how I describe a classical curve, and you see this very similar picture, what Julian was saying, and this was actually generated with a mathematical notebook that Flavio wrote, where I describe this curve on shape space, or the geometry of the curve on shape space as an I describe the curve in this intrinsic way. And now I want to do this for theories of the universe, and in particular for quantum gravity, which was my original motivation to get into this business. So I wanted originally just implement relationalism in a clear-cut way, and not in a way that where I would have to lie to myself at several steps. And then actually it makes you think, what do you want from quantum gravity? Well, the first thing is it should be a well-defined physical system. So it should be a mathematical model, and there should be a physical interpretation, but at least some of the mathematical entities, what they refer to, what they describe. I mean, usually we have a mathematical system, and if we call it a physical system, we don't have a physical interpretation for all the mathematical objects that appear, but for some of them, I want to at least have a physical interpretation, so that I can use the system to make predictions. Well, for the gravity part, I want to have a classical limit, and I want to be able to find a classical limit that is well described by Einstein's equations. And for the quantum part, this is actually the more difficult part, to say what do you actually mean with the quantum part of quantum gravity, because there. So, for example, when we do quantum field theory in a curved background, we actually define the quantum field theory using the causal structure of the background space-time. But the causal structure in quantum gravity is actually the dynamical object. So this is slightly inconsistent, so this can be a basis for perturbative quantum gravity, but definitely not for a non-perturbative definition of quantum gravity. So what I say, the weakest thing that I could come up with is that at least when I describe how one almost, for all practical purposes, isolated subsystem, and in the Newtonian body problem it would be one of these Kepler pairs, how that acquires information about another almost isolated subsystem through weak interactions, through interactions that I can treat perturbatively, that this should be described by the quantum formalism and by the usual measurement processing in the quantum formalism. So this is what I want. And then we actually were playing with this for quite a while. And the first equation that we came up with when we looked at curves on shape space, they were based basically on the classical equation of motion of gravity in CMC gauge, and there you have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, and you would guess a Schrödinger equation with a time-dependent Hamiltonian for some wave function of the universe. What you actually see is something that is again due to dimensional analysis, is that that this time variable, which has the dimension of an action, always comes paired with an h bar. So you call this evolution parameter a dimensionless evolution parameter lambda, and then you have a dimensionless Schrödinger equation for a wave function on conformal superspace. So this is basically what we ended up with. But what you see here, the problem that I have with this equation is this thing. I wanted, I wanted an equation of state of the geometry of a pure curve on shaped space and explicitly excise a time parametrization. But what this equation is telling me, even if I want to describe only the curve intrinsically, I have to introduce an external time parameter, and this is this is a price that I didn't want to pay. So I didn't want a Schrödinger equation of this sort. Then, of course, there are conceptual problems with quantum mechanics, which is the definite outcome problem, or more commonly known as the measurement problem, which I honestly don't see. Many people say it is resolved in many worlds and by decoherence. I honestly don't see how this should work for various reasons, but they would fill an entire talk by itself. And then I had a very practical problem. We had, based on discussions with Julian over several years, we had developed an idea of what relationalism should be and how we interpret intrinsically a solution in terms of how it generates its units intrinsically. And I didn't know how to implement this in the standard quantum formalism, and this is why I said I saw myself forced to use Bohmian trajectories to go to describe the history of the universe, because it turns out that all these three problems can be circumvented or solve themselves when you say the only thing that is real about the universe is a curve in shaped space, but this curve is guided by a Bohmian guidance equation. And
are you seriously claiming that Bohmian mechanics solves the measurement problem?
I'm saying that if all that is real is a curve in shaped space, and I say I only want to describe how weak interactions between, for all practical purposes, isolated subsystems, then quantum mechanics emerges as an effective description for these weak interactions. So I'm not saying I put Bohmian mechanics on top of quantum mechanics to solve the measurement problem. I'm saying I take this as my fundamental theory, and then it says, and then this problem becomes basically solved. So then I had for the Newtonian n-body problem, I had this equation of state of the curve in shape space. So I just said, well, Bohmian mechanics gives you a way to quantize equations of motion rather than Hamiltonian. So I just guessed what the guidance equation should be. So Bohmian mechanics is, of course, you add to the wave function, you add the actually realized configuration of the universe, and you use a polar split of the wave function, and then you find it's the Broglie's postulate that the gradient of the phase of the wave function acts like a momentum on the physical, on the actual, on the configuration that is actually realized in this universe, and then just going to arc-length parametrization, I get this version of the Bohmian guidance equations. Then I have a Schrödinger equation, that is, I have some Hamiltonian that acts on the wave function, and I also reparameterize it to arc lengths. And then, of course, I told you that I needed this curvature degree of freedom of the curve, and I added this by hand this curvature degree of freedom onto these equations, and just gave it an equation of motion that would, in the classical limit, would exactly go into this equation of motion. But then you need a very
you're making the hypothesis, which you're then going to see if it's confirmed by observations.
No, actually, on the next slide, I will argue that there are much simpler systems, much simpler ways to do this, and observationally, it may actually be advantageous not to use such complicated Hamiltonians, which actually have a nonlinear dependence on the wave function itself. So it's not a Schrödinger equation that you have a by hand modified nonlinear equation, but at least you can argue, and this is why I made this first choice. At least you can argue whenever the width of the wave function, the fact that the wave function has a finite width, whenever that becomes negligible, then the system goes into a classical limit that is precisely my equation of state of the curve on shape space.
Sorry, Tim, this is by explicit construction.
This is by explicit construction. I don't have any fundamental. I just want to have something that that by brute force gives me the same classical limit.
How do you take the classical limit?
So in this case, the classical limit is, so I said the system, because it's Bohmian mechanics, it traces out a definite curve. It gives you an explicit history. And the classical limit is basically when the effect that the wave function has a finite width becomes unimportant for the equations of motion, for integrating the equations of motion. So that you can neglect this part, what is in the literature is usually called the quantum potential. And when this part becomes negligible compared to the remainder of the equations of motion, then the system goes into a limit that is exactly described by this set of equations.
So you get a Hamilton-Jacobi equation?
No, I don't get a Hamilton-Jacobi equation. I get Newton's equations of this. We will see that on the next slide, actually. And then but I really didn't like that I had to make all this by hand. Adjustments to the system just to get a system that is formally exactly the same. In fact, I wanted a simple model that does that, and the simplest model is to consider Bohmian mechanics on shape space. So I'm having the usual guidance equations and the usual Schrödinger equation. And when you parameterize this in arc lengths, then you get exactly the system plus a Schrödinger equation. But what you see here is I put a little tilde over this C, over the dimensionless potential. And this C is the quantum part of the potential, which is the effect of the width of the wave function, is the modification compared to C. And that couples to the remaining degrees of freedom of the wave function of the that are guided by the Schrödinger equation. When I look just at these classical equations, then I see they look exactly the same as the ones that I had four slides before. They look exactly the same, except that I have a C tilde, so I have the I have the effect of the finite width of the wave function sits here, and instead of this and the equation for the curvature degree of freedom has a kappa times something that I now call sigma, and that is not exactly this classical form. And I will show you what this sigma is here. So this sigma here is the longitudinal part of the quantum force. So it's the gradient of the, so if you take, this is basically the Laplacian of the radial part or of the modulus of the wave function divided by the modulus of the wave function is a measure of the width of the wave function. So how the width changes when you go along shape space in the direction of the curve. This UA is the unit tangent vector along the curve. So it's the longitudinal part of the quantum force, and that plays the role of this extra of this degree of freedom that this curvature degree of freedom. So this part is the same, but how this system here closes is it closes in a on the longitudinal part of the quantum force. So when this part, when the longitudinal part of the quantum force is negligible, you can integrate basically the scale, the effective scale of the system that you would obtain by looking at this curve on shape space, and you see that it is asymptotic, that it has a minimum. It has a minimal scale, so it's also U-shaped, but asymptotically it grows linearly with Newtonian time. This just comes out from solving a system of a second-order differential equation that is satisfied with this, which is what Julian would call the ephemeris equation for ephemeris time. So when I say it expands apparently like this R of t, I have to explain to you with respect to what, because I'm just defining a system on shape space. So what I need to do is, in this simple model, I need some almost isolated bound systems. So I need, for example, a system when I'm on pre-shaped space, I'm modeled by translations and by the overall scale of the system. Then I can say that I have an isolated pair, say particle 1 and 2, is to say that the first three of the shape degrees of freedom, that they satisfy this inequality, that they are basically pi half up to very small fluctuations, and that the normalized Newtonian potential takes this form. This is generic. This is exactly what when you calculate the Newton potential, what comes out. I'm just saying, what I'm saying is particle 1 sits at the origin, particle 2 should be close to the origin, and this is the condition. They're just angle variables, these q's. And so the Newton potential takes this form. So I have in particular when I'm close to pi half, this becomes essentially 1, and the cosines become essentially q's. And so I get the Hamiltonian. I get a Hamiltonian for the rest of the system plus. Plus a Laplacian for Q1 in a flat space Laplacian, minus a 1 over R potential, plus a Hamiltonian for the rest, and an interaction Hamiltonian that is small due to this assumption, so I will treat it perturbatively. So then I say, well, then in Bohmian mechanics, because I have an actual configuration of the universe, I can say I can get an effective wave function for the subsystem by putting in the wave function for the rest. And then this effective wave function, when I can treat this H interaction as a perturbation, satisfies the Schrödinger equation for the hydrogen atom. So I know its solution, and I know I can calculate its Bohr radius. And I just get 1 over 2c as the Bohr radius, where c is the normalization of the maximum of this shape potential. So I have an explicit width on shape space, an explicit size on the angles of shape space, that is proportional to 1 over the coupling constant, as we expect. When it's stronger coupled, the atoms become smaller. And when I have, and then there is like what Julian has been telling us for a long time, when you have a system like this, you have an ephemeris. Equation for time, basically by the classical motion of the rest of the system, you get an approximate time variable. So if you have a periodic excitation of this of the system in this ephemeris time, then you get transition frequencies, and this gives you the Rydberg energy, and this defines you a unit of time. A preferred unit of time that you can experience by interacting from the subsystem with the rest of the system. So this system that I introduced here, actually it develops atoms, gives me units of length and time. And now I can explicitly express what does this expansion mean. So now I have what is unambiguously defined on shape space is the ratios of interparticle distances. So I have the particle 1, 2 that define my atom. The equilibrium position between the quantum force and the classical force is essentially the Bohr radius. So I call this R0, and I can pull it out, and I get and I can calculate all these ratios. And then in these units of R0, I get an R of Q. And the dynamics of this capital R of Q gives me, in terms of Bohr units, how the scale degree of freedom of the system evolves, given in this unit. So what changes is the ratio between the size of the atoms and the distances between the atoms. And I can give you exactly the equation for that. So there are actually several subtleties in doing this. But what I can do is I can give you an this was the story for the n-body problem, but you can do a very similar thing for ADM gravity, and we actually started understanding this using the ADM system in CMC gauge, and this is how this is in large part why we read papers by Jim Eisenberg, who is here. Then it was York, Jacques Brois, and then Neil O'Murdoch, several people in the 1960s and 70s. Developed the theory of the ADM system, first for the initial value problem, and then I think it was Fisher and Marston who developed it into a dynamical, who really worked out the dynamical systems aspect of this system. So what is important in this is that the local scale, so the local volume element, and the local expansion, so the local Hubble rate, or how this spatial volume element expands locally, that they can be that the equation of motion for the conformal metric and the trace free part, so the conformal momenta, that they decouple from these ratios, except they depend only on other dimensionless ratios, exactly by the same reasons that I told you about in the Newtonian n-body problem. So what I need to do is, and this is slightly different from how usually the CMC system is presented, I say I want that the local volume element, that it's that the change of the local volume element does not depend on space. So I can, so if it only, I fix it once and for all, and then it doesn't change with time anymore. And then I just calculate what kind of Laplace functions do I need, Laplace function do I need for that. I need this constant crunch Laplace function, this root g over the trace of the metric momenta. And then I look for an intrinsic time parametrization, like I did for the arc length parametrization in the n-body problem. And I get something, well, I can express it in terms of how the conformal metric changes. And then I get a local, so then the local part of the conformal factor is completely, has no dynamics anymore. It's just a background density. And only the total volume remains in the dynamical system. And the expansion is determined by solving the Hamilton constraint. This is just when if I have no matter, it's just 6 times sigma squared minus r. And if I have matter, I have to add these two to get the expression for pi squared. So now I do this, and I want to say, how does the conformal metric change when I do a step in this arc length? Which is, of course, I need this background density to define arc lengths on conformal superspace, because I'm actually not working on conformal superspace. I still work with Riemannian metrics. And then I see, well, I've gone to the conformal momenta, but they still have a dimension of 1 over time, because they're momenta. So I normalize them by the total, by the root of the total kinetic energy, by this, and this is why I put a sigma, a hat on the conformal momenta. Those are the normalized momenta. And then you put in all these definitions and you calculate about 5 pages on paper, and the first equation of motion is just replacing all this, how the conformal metric changes. It's just putting in all the definitions here. So this is, and it's just a kinematic statement. The second equation of motion uses the ADM equations of motion, and they're already large. You insert all these definitions, and it becomes, there would be about 2 pages in this. So this is why I just say this is some function that, and I point out what it depends on. It depends on the conformal metric. It depends on the background density that I use. It depends on the normalized conformal momenta. And it depends on the volume on one more dimensionless degree of freedom, which is this kappa, which is a similar kappa as what I had in the n-body problem. And it turns out to be the mean of the trace of the metric momenta divided by the kinetic energy by a measure for the energy in change of shape. And then you see that this completely decouples, and the system of equations of motion, it's tedious work, but at the end you see that you get a system of equations that is of this form. So it's exactly of the same form as in the Newtonian n-body problem. So the entire logic that we developed for the Newtonian n-body problem can be applied to the ADM system. And so this is, we actually, and I think Dave will talk about this, we actually used this system and investigated a symmetry reduced version of this, the Bianchi-Nye model with a scalar field here. I just show you how this works with a usual the ADM Hamiltonian under the symmetry reduction goes to this form. You have anisotropy parameters and and a direction on shape space, you have just two anisotropy parameters that for Bianchi models. So there is only one angle that specifies the direction, and then you put in this and you get for pure Bianchi 9 with a cosmological constant, you get this system. And then you have this sigma here. And this sigma is due to the fact, so you get a, so you, I explained this. These Qs describe the spatial conformal metric, homogeneous spatial conformal metrics. These phi, the single degree of freedom phi, describes how this is changing, the direction of change. This kappa here, the phi, is related to the extrinsic curvature in the same way as in the Newtonian model. But then there appears an additional degree of freedom sigma here. And this is due to the fact that I have an additional dimensionful constant in this system. And something very similar will happen in the talk of Yuri Bonda. He will also have an additional degree of freedom due to the appearance of an energy and the speed of light to close the system. And this degree of freedom is related to what you call the jerk, or the first derivative in arc lengths of the extrinsic curvature of the curve. So now once I have the system, I know exactly how to I know to guess a Bohmian model for it. So I have a guidance equation on this mini superspace and a quantum Hamiltonian on this mini superspace, and I get exactly this classical limit, except that sigma is again turned into the longitudinal part of the quantum force. So the effect of the cosmological constant in this simple model mini superspace model is the same, except the degree of freedom that describes the effect of the cosmological constant is the longitudinal part of the quantum force in this system. So once I understood that, I thought, well, now I understand how in very simple models for quantum dynamics on shape space, in these symmetry reduced models, I understand how to produce the effects of a cosmological constant or of a dynamically evolving cosmological constant. So I would like to do this in something that is more realistic. Unfortunately, I'm running out of time, but I will give you the gist of this. What it actually turns out is when you want to do these Bohmian systems for field theories, the pure fact that you want that the Bohmian equations of motion remain well defined, so that such a guidance equation does not, that the right hand side of this guidance equation is well defined, requires renormalization. It doesn't require anything of unitarity. It doesn't require what you usually do in Hamiltonian language for renormalization is that you require that the Hamiltonian is essentially self-adjoint. Here it comes purely from the fact that you want the Bohmian guidance equation for field configuration to be well defined. You go through all of this that I have here, and you do, and I will, if you're interested in the, I will, I actually want to talk to some people about this. but due to the fact that I'm running out of time, I'm just giving you the gist of this. When I run this program and I only want that the equations of motion for a scalar field coupled to a Bianchi to a quantum Bianchi cosmology, is well defined, remain well defined, then I have to subtract the usual vacuum energy part. This is the usual thing that you have, but in flat space you have to normal order the scalar field Hamiltonian. And you get the same effect down here, but this is now a pure this thing when we couple it to the simple shape dynamics model, this thing only appears with this reference density omega zero, which does not affect the equations of motion for the shape part, nor does it affect the equations of motion for the scalar field. So it does not affect the curve on shape space. It's a purely additive constant in the Hamiltonian. This part, the renormalization of Newton's constant, this affects the equations of motion on shape space. But this leads to it's a very robust argument that I don't see a way out. However, vacuum energy can affect the Bohmian equations of motion, and in particular, the quantum force part is unaffected by vacuum energy. So this is, of course, very early stages, because what I'm doing here is I'm not considering a quantum gravity model. I'm considering the effect of a free quantum field on a quantum cosmology. So this is, and actually there are several steps missing in this to make something like this a quantum gravity theory. Basically, the only thing that I know to do is to use for the Bohmian equations a background field formalism, and then impose that for the Bohmian equations of motion remain well defined for the fluctuation field, and then do a perturbation ansatz and try to solve the split symmetry. But this is something that I can say in words, but I have no idea how to do it practically. I mean, I know how to do this, how to do this first part, how to do this split, and how to make the equations of motion at least at a perturbative level well defined for the fluctuation field. But I don't know how to do the second part to turn it into a quantum gravity theory by doing this. So with this, I come to my conclusion. So I've started with a way to implement Julian's relational ideas, or what he told me, in the formalization that all counts for the to describe the universe as a whole is that I want to describe the geometry of a curve in relational configuration space, or in shape space. And with that, at least at the classical level, we can find a description of general relativity on shape space that is empirically indistinguishable from general relativity. There are certain solutions, of course, of general relativity that are not globally hyperbolic. These cannot be described as this. But I mean, local dynamics of gravity is described by this system, and it leads classically to exactly the same. The classical system locally is exactly the same. Then I said the simplest way to apply this logic that we developed for the classical theory in a realm that could qualify for a quantum gravity theory is apply the same logic to Bohmian trajectories. And this Bohmian equation of motion need renormalization. But what turns out is that these Bohmian systems expand due to a very curious fact. And I put it on one slide, and I forgot to mention it, but it is actually an important point. It is the fact when you describe a curve on shape space, then the direction has 1 degree less of freedom than the curve. So I have only the angles to describe the direction. But if I have a wave function on shape space, and I'm at a point, then the gradient of the phase of the wave function has a direction and it has a length. So this length degree of freedom is precisely what is causing the the effects of expansion, and is precisely what is driving the longitudinal part of the quantum force. If this wasn't there, I would not get the effects of expansion in the system. And what I put here at the last point is more a provocation than a definite conclusion. It's that I have presented you a framework where I can start from Julian's first principles, and where I can at least try to turn this into a quantization of quantum shape dynamics, and at least at the conceptual level, I'm very clear of what I want from this system. I don't have to lie about the framework, and I think to make it a provocative statement to conclude. So Astrid is laughing when I say to make a provocative statement to conclude. What I think is so at the end of the 1970s, to my understanding of history in quantum gravity, which is before I ever thought about, before I entered, much later, more than 20 years later, 30 years later almost, the status was very similar. One had the background field formalism. One had all the tools about renormalization, about how to take the continuum limit in the background field formalism, and people tried to apply honestly this quantization program to gravity, to general relativity, and they found it was not working for several technical reasons. And I think, to make this a provocative statement at the end, that no, thank you is not a provocative statement. I thank you for your attention in a minute. That here we have a very different set of postulates, a very different set of principles that we want to implement in a quantum theory of gravity, or in a Bohmian theory of on conformal superspace, and so the usual arguments why quantum gravity runs into problems, for example, about unitarity, that it's non-renormalizable. These arguments do not apply to this framework. These questions have to be asked separately and have to be evaluated in a completely different framework, because we are asking completely different questions. We are seeing very similar technical problems, but we are not. But the technical problems, what they mean for the physical status of the theory, is very different. So with that, I thank you.
Okay, so now we're going to have, a 20-minute discussion session, so we can also address questions.
Can we have 5 minutes for me to make a dash to the bathroom. I've just a moment to break before we start the discussion.
Well, that's 10 questions.
Well, that's 10 questions.
Hmm?
Right. We'll just keep it on.
Yeah. I'll be back in a second.
Yes, Jim?
So I don't know anything about the quantum stuff, but I'm trying to understand the purely classical stuff. So in some of the earlier discussions of shape dynamics, etc., there was always a slight problem with that you were assuming that there were constant curvature slices. Here it doesn't seem to be
that. Yes.
However, the one nice thing about the constant curvature foliations is at least there one has the notion of where one can show that it's a well posed
yes.
system. And that's so what I'm wondering is with the choice of gauge that you're making, because I understand what you were doing, if you're writing general relativity, making a particular choice of gauge, which I think I'm pretty clear. So is that a well posed is the
I have in this system, I have looked at the equations of motion, and if you go back to that, I'm making I'm not assuming anything about omega
so
of x.
Initially, it's anything you want.
And also, you see, this is not a complete system in the sense of what you're describing. What I need to turn on this system is I need to put in initial data. The momentum part I solve, but I have to solve the momentum the trace part for the momenta I solve, solving the Hamilton constraint algebraically. But I need to solve the momentum constraint, and I don't know whether this is whether this is possible to do for an arbitrary. So it may be that this is only well defined if I take the initial slice to be a CMC slice.
Wow.
Then I think we are at the same status. Then the initial value problem is at the same status as in CMC gauge. But then I evolve with.
Which don't admit
anything. Yes, but I have the same restrictions there. But then I evolve with this labs. I mean, once I have initial data, I evolve with this labs. This is what I'm specifying.
Have you looked at what you might add for the momentum constraint, whether you have any well posing results?
No, I have not. I have not looked at that. I've just. What I was interested in was in the decoupling and the equations of motion. Yes, I completely agree that to have a complete dynamical system you need not only the equations of motion, you also need the initial value problem. I think it is possible because this evolution is not incompatible with putting one initial slice where you have that is CMC.
Why?
This is not inconsistent. So I can at least for space terms that admit one CMC slice, I take initial data there. And then I evolve with this lapse
right.
from there.
I like the idea that you're allowing for non-CMC, but if one does allow for non-CMC, you want to again check if you have well posed.
It's
a history of numerical stuff that's taught us that without that, you can run into some trouble.
Because
it depends on what you want to get out of it. If you're just trying to start, set it up as something that you quantize, then again, I know nothing about that, but if you want to treat it as a system where you're trying to understand the long-time dynamics, et cetera, of these.
I mean, actually, at this point, I'm not, to be very blunt about it, I want this to get a hunch of what the equations of motion for a quantum system should look like. So I wrote them very schematically here because they're horrible. But then within this Bohmian framework, I have a way to basically quantize equations of motion rather than Hamiltonians. And that's what and that's why I'm interested in these equations of motion. What you then would then, if you want, if you also want a the complete set of initial data to be, or at least a large set of initial data to be to lead to well-defined evolution and so on, this is a completely different question that is not in the not in the questions that I that I'm looking at right now.
So Eric,
I have a couple of questions about the quantum stuff. So I guess two, they really boil down to two questions. So at the beginning, you mentioned that you like relational, conceptualize things relationally, because you want to separate out the conventions, definitions from what this actually predicts. So in the Bohmian picture, Bohmians usually operationalize the quantum potential by relating it to the Born rule.
No, this is not. This is not how I think about Bohmian mechanics. So what I think, so what many people who talk about Bohmian mechanics say, well, there is the wave function and there is and the configuration, and both things have somehow ontological status as being real. For me, the only thing that I consider as physically real is the curve in shape space. So the in a way, the wave function is just something like the momenta in classical physics. I need them to calculate the evolution, but I don't say that a momentum really exists as something really here. So it affects if I kick a ball, it moves, it has an effect for the evolution, but it doesn't change the fact that the ball is here.
Isn't the difference in this argument? I mean, the momenta you can integrate out to arrive at particular order equations of motion. The wave function, you cannot integrate out to obtain equations at the for this. In this Bohmian picture, you cannot integrate out the wave function. That's the whole.
No, but I mean, when you integrate it out, then you need to specify, of course, the velocities if you integrate out the momenta. For the equations of motion.
No, the Bohmian picture. You can only integrate outside.
Yeah, but it's the same thing. To specify the state of the classical system, I need the momenta.
But you're talking about integrating it out at the level of the action, right? I think here he has a clear picture at the level of the equations of motion.
No, what I'm arguing about is I'm saying we live in actual configuration space. We don't live in momentum space. It's actually, there's a savvy phrase that Chris Isham says, imagine to have sex in momentum space. It was Chris Isham, actually you were there when he was saying that. Imagine to have sex in momentum space. it's to say, we live in configuration space. The momentum space is not perceivable to us.
Well, I think they did that in San Francisco, actually.
What?
It was a bad joke.
Am I interrupting something? So, Sean had a question. I also had a question.
Can I jump in about this?
Yeah.
So, you're the only physical reality, is the point.
Yeah, I mean, this is.
Okay, but how do you derive all the baggage? Experimental support for quantum mechanics, so the Born rule and the.
So in this picture, the Born rule comes about, and this is probably also answering part of Eric's question. So the Born rule is about what a typical Bohmian trajectory, what records of measurements are generated when you have something that you can describe as a frequency measurement, for example. So you have a system. Imagine you have one almost isolated system, and you have two types of interactions with this system, and they interact with different records, and they give you a time sequence. at the end. So then you get records basically of measuring A and measuring B, measuring A, measuring B, and so forth. And then the outcomes of these measurements are recorded in these records. And then the Born rule actually is the frequency of certain outcomes of measurements being existing in these records for a typical Bohmian trajectory, for one typical. I'm not taking an ensemble of trajectories and assuming that I somehow have an ensemble of, I say, in one particularly realized universe, if I model measurements by weak interactions between my systems and records, then the typical trajectory for this universe on the trajectory on configuration space gives me this frequency of outcomes. This is my reading of an interpretation that is in two long papers by Goldstein, Dürr, there are two others on these. But they talk about typicality of one realization of these Bohmian trajectories in records. And then you can actually calculate and derive the Born rule from this.
Okay, so Roberto.
But actually, I think the interpretation should go the other way around. But this is a different, because the quantum formalism is an experienced formalism that you get as an effective description for describing subsystems. So some subsystem acquires information through weak interactions about another, and then you want to make predictions based on this incomplete knowledge. So you assign a density matrix to this subsystem, you evolve it, and so on. And in this way, I see a much cleaner picture of how the quantum formalism emerges for an effective description of subsystems. For what I actually said in words here. For the acquisition of information of one partially isolated or practically isolated subsystem, how it acquires information about another when I have weak interactions between them.
So there's nothing really like superposition here of the geometries. It's just that when it looks like something is in a superposition, it's just following a very non-classical trajectory.
It's just following a very non-classical trajectory, and that gives you the effect of. This gives you the physical consequences of having been in a superposition. Yes?
I want to go back to your subtitle.
Okay.
So at some point you said that the quartic renormalization
let's go to this point here. So what I argued in this Bianchi model is the shape space description of a Bianchi model. So I have the anisotropy parameters. So there are two for a three sphere. There are two anisotropy parameters. I call them QA, and I have momenta conjugate to them. And this is the Hamilton constraint, where this is the Ricci scalar for let's say quote unquote unit volume. So the cosmological constant term is this term here, and you have this the volume squared. You multiply this once by the volume, the usual integrated homogeneous ADM constraint, and then you end up with this version of the ADM Hamiltonian. So the labs that you use for this would be the total volume.
Why do you say so in the subtitle?
Okay, so I'm what I'm saying, so let me make this a better subtitle that is less catchy is that vacuum energy does not gravitate in shape dynamics, but actually there is an effect of the cosmological constant in this, and this is the following. So up until here, if I were to truncate the system here at this point, so if I would throw away this kappa sigma term, then I would be in a system that would be without a cosmological constant. But the effect of the fact that I have another ratio of energies that is independent, which is basically the kinetic energy in units of the cosmological constant multiplied by v squared. This is another dimensionless ratio that exists in the system. This is basically the origin of this jerk degree of freedom of the curve on this.
Remember the definition. How is kappa related to lambda?
So kappa is related to the kappa as on the geometry of the curve is related to the curvature. On shape space, it is related to the ratio between kinetic energy in expansion and kinetic energy in change of shape, on this ratio.
I'm just a bit puzzled because I don't see lambda in those equations.
No. Down here there is no lambda because I have something that is dimensionless and scale invariant, so I cannot have any dimensionful quantities down here. So I'm just saying, this system of equations, so a curve in mini superspace that is described by this geometry, whose geometry is described by these equations, is the same curve as the one that is generated by this Hamiltonian.
Now, if you take the lambda you've got in your top line and I multiply by 2, what number changes?
The equations do not change.
The ratio between p and lambda has now changed.
But I also don't have the overall p because I only have the ratio.
Yeah, where does that ratio show?
Okay, the ratio. Okay, if you want p over lambda, then sigma would change. This sigma here would change. So if you change the dimensionless ratio, you get the.
So the claim is that, like, changing lambda, it doesn't look like it's in the equation, but actually does change, has some effect on the curvature.
Yes, you don't. This is different in the Bianchi 9 model from the Bianchi 1 model. If you have a Bianchi 1 cosmology, the system actually closes here. It doesn't even depend on kappa. And you get only this geodesic equation. Actually, the C is 0. The C becomes 0. So the equation is only that dQ, so the anisotropy goes in a certain direction, and this direction doesn't change. In any of the other Bianchi models, it's just Bianchi 1 because it's spatially flat. It doesn't have dependence on the spatial Ricci scalar.
This treatment of lambda smells thermodynamically wrong. Because, I mean, one of the fundamental tenets of thermodynamics is that energy is fungible. It can transform any kind of energy into any other kind of energy. And you're telling me that whatever energy is encoded in lambda, because it's part of the stress energy tensor, so it's stress energy. You're telling me that it's thermodynamically special.
It's not special. I'm not treating it special. I'm treating it exactly like all other. This is why it can only appear. Why it can only affect the curve on shape space through the ratios with other energies. The only thing that can affect, I mean, this is just dimensional analysis. If you look at the curve in mini superspace, it's dimensionless mini superspace because we're the only effect that lambda, the only way in which lambda can affect this the geometry of this curve is through ratios of kinetic energy and
unfortunately, we only have time for one more question, but we need to go to lunch and we can continue the discussion.
How do you picture the Newton constant arising when there's a scale of variable?
So the Newton constant, this is a good question. I have written here C of Q, and this is rather cryptic, because I'm writing C of Q. This is actually the spatial Ricci scalar expressed as a function of the anisotropy parameters for some in this parameterization for some unit choice of total volume, and the same thing happens in full GR where you have inhomogeneous metrics. So of course you have one. You can say, for example, the Ricci, the integral of the Ricci scalar at the round metric on a sphere takes a particular value, and I can normalize this to be one by setting a coupling constant here. And basically, this constant is through the ratios, because only ratios of these quantities occur, set then a scale for the coupling to matter. And this is the only way in which you can see Newton's constant is in pure gravity. If you rescale Newton's constant, you're only rescaling, you're only doing a change of the same dimensional change in the volume, in the momenta, and you don't see you get the same curve in shape space. So you trace out, you get the same solution, only rescaled. This convention sets the coupling to matter, and then when it couples to matter, I don't know if I have some extra slides in this, and maybe I left it in some, because I had it in some previous talks.
So from a pure scalar point of view, that coupling should be zero. Why should it
be? No. Okay. So I'm not. What affects the curve is the dimensionless ratio between whatever I get. Between whatever the gravity part of the Hamiltonian, and this will be Dave will, in his talk he will have. I should have left, or maybe I have it at the end here. No, I don't. I used to have a slide where you also had the coupling to matter on here. But what appears is that then you have a matter, say the total energy that is in matter, and the conversion rate of how you convert a particular value of matter density into these ratios, that is something that affects the curve on shape space. That affects in mini superspace models. You can explicitly work it out how it affects the curve. Although you're completely in them, you only describe the curve in mini superspace, so without in a conformal mini superspace, the shape of the curve, so the how the curve bends is affected by the matter, and this is how Newton's constant, how the strength of Newton's constant appears.
Okay,
I just wanted to say, in the extended representation, you have n. Dimensional quantities. When you go to shape space, you have n minus one, and they show up they're essentially dimensionless ratios, and you can see their effects on the curve.
Yes, yes.
And if you've only got one, which is the Newton potential, in Jacobi's principle, you've got energy zero, then there's none left when you go to shape space.
Mm-hmm.
So
I mean, this is one thing that I said at the end of the of the decoupling story, these equations, because the left-hand side is dimensionless, the right-hand side has to be dimensionless. So if you, so the last dimensionful quantity automatically decouples. When you now, when you have anything, when you have any two quantities that are dimensionful, their ratio still appears.
But wouldn't that same be same hold in a world, say, where there's an R squared gravity or C mu lambda sigma squared, no R term? Suppose to say the R term is zero, but you have the formal gravity.
I would have to work it out what this means for the curve from shape space. It would definitely not take this simple form, because this simple form it could actually take this form. I just I
you shall continue this during lunch as musical.
Thank you.